Without further ado, I'd like to pass over to David to open with his remarks.
Thank you very much. Well, firstly, thank you for the invitation. This is the second time I've been at the Political Studies Association in recent years. I was once at one way, way back when I was a student of Bernard Crick's in Brighton, and I remember vividly Bernard getting into an argument with Sir Keith Joseph, which we continued on the train, and we were travelling second, so Keith Joseph joined us in second class. And when we got off the train, Bernard dropped his suitcase, which rolled onto the railway line, and his silk pyjamas came out. And he and Sir Keith Joseph had an interesting conversation about the philosophy of that as well. So it's nice to be back. Who was it that persuaded me after the last 3 weeks to be here in defence of politics? We've had, a few weeks ago, the bizarre episode of did the Prime Minister actually ride a retired Met police horse? We've had the cold versus hot pasties. We've had the jerry can incidents. And we've had, of course, the election of the former member for Baghdad South as the new MP for Bradford West. So it's been... and we've had the granny tax as well. So we've had a very strange time. And it struck me that Bernard would not forgive me if I didn't say how appropriate it is, not simply because of his book In Defence of Politics, written 50 years ago, but because Bernard spent a lot of time in the 1970s over here in Belfast, fruitlessly as it was at the time, but laying some of the foundations by being involved in behind-the-scenes peace processes then. And I just wanted to start off by saying that In Defence of Politics is in defence of being an active citizen. And I don't think that, if you'll just forgive me, Matt, because you're very active on these fronts, this is a really good start to a speech in front of the PSA, but enough academics are actually engaged. I don't mean engaged in the party sense, although I'd be very glad if you were, but actually engaged in defending the political process and democracy and getting involved in how we can defend citizenship in the curriculum in schools and improve it rather than seeing it abolished, in actually being prepared to speak out and to engage, because without it, I fear we're going to slip into a really difficult and dangerous situation where the disparagement of politics in general and the bizarre processes of having a coalition government actually lead to even greater disillusionment. And of course, here in Northern Ireland, the replacement of the bullet and the bomb by the ballot paper is an absolutely sound example of why politics is so crucial to our well-being and to the processes of democracy. Again, I remember Bernard, I was in a restaurant with him in London, and a number of politicians from Northern Ireland came into the restaurant, and one of them said hello to me, and Bernard looked up in his inimitable way and said, I remember you when you were in the UDA, or worse. And they scuttled off as fast as possible because Bernard had remembered the days of the bullet and the bomb. We're also in a period of bread and circuses. I tread carefully here. I've written an article for this week's Radio Times about my experiences in meeting the Queen, and she's wonderful, and I don't say anything other than the Jubilee is a great occasion. But we have the Olympics in London and the Jubilee at the time of the horse and the pasties, and we are in danger of seeing the political arena through the prism of entertainment rather than of serious values and what is facing us for the future. And I just want to say a word or two about how we as politicians, Peter is speaking on this more clearly, need to get our act together, need to be braver and stronger in terms of not just defending the process but what it is we're about. Back in 2007-08, the financial global meltdown was an occasion when politicians across Europe and North America, who were mainly affected, could have spelt out a narrative as to how the political process, not just representative democracy, but participative democracy, was actually about to save the world from the worst of the collapse of our financial and economic institutions, and how it was the political process that was going to be able to pull people together to actually provide what Bernard would have described as a countervailing force to the unfettered market and to the way in which the financial institutions, working on their own behalf and in their own interests, had virtually brought the system to its knees. And we didn't. We weren't helped, of course, by politicians getting involved in the allowances scandal. In April 2009, Gordon Brown, whatever you may think of him, had done a really good job in pulling together the G20 in London, and there was the beginnings of real coordination in terms of facing that global meltdown. And then, literally 3 weeks later, the Daily Telegraph revealed that they'd got the disc and started the process, and we panicked and flapped about like headless chickens. And as a consequence, the world in the UK, certainly, and this was reflected in other ways across Europe, started to see politicians as the problem, not the solution, and politics as a major contributor to the global financial meltdown, rather than something that was going to counterweight it and to protect the interests of ordinary men and women and individuals. And this morning, I just want to say that we've got to get back onto the track of spelling out how representative democracy and participation are the counterweight to the market and to global power, to wealth and privilege, to the uncertainties, insecurities and fear which rapid global change brings in the lives of men and women who do not have access to anything except the ballot box and their participation in politics. And if we can start to spell that out more clearly, we can then engage, and I haven't got time this morning to go into it, but I'm going to try and write about it during the course of this year, how we can use politics to mobilise the power of people in their own lives. We saw it in South Africa, including with the boycotts. We saw it actually in an interesting way in 2004-05, leading up to the Glen Eagles summit in July of that year. The impact of what happened in terms of both debt relief and climate change was somewhat diminished in the UK because of the bombing on the 7th of July, just at the time that agreement was being reached. But the 1.5 million people who, many young people, who walked through Edinburgh were the final culmination of a superb campaign here and across the globe in terms of Make Poverty History. We can mobilise in all sorts of ways with the backing of government and political parties to make people believe that they have a role to play. If schools are going to be fragmented in the UK and the education system is going to be balkanised, then we need to get to the governors on those schools and ensure that they feel in a small p way that they're involved in making key decisions and holding people to account. If the health service is to be undermined and fractured as it is in the UK, we need to ensure that local people get engaged in holding those who are on the commissioning groups to account. We need to bring pressure to bear, as we have in my own city, to get those involved in the commissioning process to reinvent a light touch primary care trust and to see off the privatisation and the intrusion of those who are simply in it to make money. In other words, we've got to revitalise politics. We've got to get people to feel that it's something to do with them, that they can make a difference, not just in setting up a mother and toddler group or a day centre, but actually in changing the substantial issues around them. And by doing so, they can also see their way to changing and helping and supporting the combating of rapid global change that destroys their lives. And that's a two-way street. It's government engaging and supporting people, and it's people as a tide that enable government to do far more in this very different world than they would otherwise be able to do. We failed to spell that out over the last 5 years. That's a major disadvantage, of course, for Social Democrats, because if you believe that government is a tool for enabling the market to succeed more readily, and therefore to enable private enterprise, in the famous words of an Aaron Bevan, to suck at the teats of the state. Not very elegant, but it puts it pretty clearly. Then you're on a different trajectory. At the moment, politicians slagging politicians, the press slagging politicians, the judiciary threatening politicians, as they are here in Northern Ireland, threatening Peter Hayne, as the former Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, with an ancient law which is called scandalising the courts, which is about contempt, then we need to speak out that the only voice, the only way, the only tool that most people have in their lives is to get engaged in politics and to use their vote. In 1987, when I was elected for the first time to Parliament, I won the most phenomenal majority of over 24,000. We were all jumping about thinking that the world had changed. People in Brightside voted in very large numbers in a way they hadn't before and they haven't since. And actually, it made no damn difference whatsoever to what I was able to do in Parliament. And the lesson from that, like it or not, was that we had to be able to reach out to those who didn't understand what it was like to live on the council estates that I was brought up in, or to be really poor, or not to have a job, so that they too could be part of the political process in ensuring that we have the power to do something to improve the lives and make a difference to the communities that I represent. That's why I'm pleased that you're involved in your own way in the political process, and I'm pleased still to have some fire left in my belly after all these years to come and talk to you this morning. Thank you very much.